Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening?
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
And NPR.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
And this
is Radiolab.
Yes, and today we have three very different
but equally awesome journeys, I like to call them.
Yes, journeys, questions, three different
they're
questions.
They're questions, really.
Yes, that we're going to investigate. And to get us started, we'll take it away.
It's something you do every day. You don't think about it very much, but when you do it in New York City, strange things happen.
What is the it? What are you talking about?
I don't know. It's a tease.
Are you going to tell me what it is?
Well, I can tell you that it all started with this guy.
I'll go with this. That's good.
A writer who's been on the show a few times.
No, I'm Frederick Kaufman, the author of Bet the Farm, How Food Stopped Being Food.
We brought him in to tell us a story about poop. So Fred told us that the first thing we had to do
about North River sewage treatment plant
was we had to go to North River wastewater treatment plant.
Huh. Just go there and cross over.
It's just over on the Upper West Side of Manhattan.
Usually, how often do you come here?
So our producer Pat Walters and I, we went up there.
Yeah.
Why was I included in this adventure?
You weren't. I don't know. Walters just muscled his way into position.
Walters again.
Boy, how you doing? Right.
Anyway, we went up there and we ended up talking to this guy, Steve.
Pat.
Hi, Pat. How you doing? I'm Steve Askew. How you doing?
I'm Robert.
Hi, Rob. How are you? Have a seat. Have a seat. Okay.
He's like the
I've been on camera before.
Superintendent of the plant up there.
Steve is basically the eliminator. He eliminates a very significant portion of New York City's poop.
We have it. I think it's a really neat job.
Consider the glory of this position.
It's pretty exciting because, again, you really get to see this.
Because Steve's at the beginning of a process that I think we all kind of know the outline of, but the details and the places that New York City's poop in particular end up taking you are truly astonishing. So, the first thing that we learned is that in New York City, this whole wastewater treatment thing, it happens on an almost unbelievable scale.
How many gallons do we...
About, citywide, about 1.3 billion gallons.
Every
single day. That's 7.45 pounds per gallon, you know, 7 billion pounds.
But until 1986, we dumped pretty much all of it into the ocean or straight into the Hudson River.
1986, and that's like yesterday. You know, can imagine the west side of Manhattan before 1986, all the sewage went into the river.
Unprocessed?
Unprocessed.
It just went straight into the river, untreated.
That blows my mind.
Yeah, it was not a good situation. But by 1986, the city had built several treatment plants, including this one, which happens to be the biggest.
It's a very impressive building with trees on top and soccer fields, and I watched it get built. It's right near my neighborhood, so kids played soccer up there.
They played soccer on top of the poop place?
Yeah.
Did you have any sense of what lies inside that building?
No. I had no... Oh, no.
We're going to walk according to the process, all right?
In the walking tours I've had of New York City, this beats everything.
So we're going to enter through the doors marked exit. That's always a good
way. That's always a good one.
So imagine parkland on top and a kind of an open framework, sort of like a parking garage.
And we're like up on the top level with the treatment plant itself underneath us. And Steve walks us over to this manhole cover, opens it up.
Here and look down and see.
And we look down.
That's where the water comes in.
Well below the highways. I mean, there's this
like a river.
River of everything.
It's this boiling brown torrent. Way below us.
The bottom of that channel is 100 feet down.
And so the first thing Steve has to do is, like, get it up out of there.
We pump it up 100 feet, and it cascades down through the rest of the process, ultimately back to the river.
And at this point,
it becomes a series of waterfalls.
That was like Niagara.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Pouring down below us through this 8-story staircase of pools, almost like terraced lakes.
Look how high that is. Each part of the process is lower.
And each pool has its own job. Starting from the top, there's like one room where they just skim the oil off the surface.
Fats, oils, and greases float to the top and we skim them off.
Sewage flows down again.
So we're gonna walk down
into this enormous wide open space.
This is impressive. This feels
it's a big long gallery here, yeah.
Like a huge rectangular lake.
An indoor lake, kind of.
That's correct.
Of warm sewage.
So if the air temperature is cold enough, the vapor condenses on the cold concrete and it rains inside the building.
Really?
If it's really cold...
It rains, or you mean drips?
Call it whatever. It condenses and comes down in droplets. That's the definition of rain. And it's all be soaking wet in here because it's raining. And if it's really cold, that vapor freezes and we'll have snow on the floor. All right?
You have a real climate.
Meanwhile, in the lake, the sludgy stuff kind of settles down to the bottom and gets sent along down to another level, to the next step. And as you go down deeper and deeper, eventually you get to this one room that's, like, weirdly kind of beautiful.
It had a kind of dome-like top, and there was a big pond in front of you.
It's frothy, it's alive, and got a nice light tan color to it.
The pond was brimming with life.
So now it becomes a biological process.
One that is spookily similar to what happens in our own stomachs.
We heat it to 98 degrees, lo and behold, it's coming from humans.
And this is where they add a bunch of bacteria to the sewage.
The sewage is actually food to this bacteria.
And then Steve adds other bacteria to eat those bacteria.
Eating each other. The acid formers eat the complex proteins and carbohydrates, and the methane formers eat the acid formers. And then
cannibal fest.
Everything's eating everything else.
Go from bugs.
And not just bacteria.
There were little mayflies and bugs crawling on the surface. And everywhere around the room, there were enormous populations of
spiders.
Spiders.
They're all over the place.
Spiders eat the midges. The midges eat the sludge. The spiders eat the midges. And if this was an outdoor plant, we'd have birds eating the spiders. It's a whole ecosystem. It's exactly right.
So wow. New York City has in its waste treatment plant a rainforest filled with animals.
But of course, the product of all this...
Go through that door, which just says...
Smell something.
...is disgusting.
Oh, yeah. Oh. it's so bad, I just want to smell more of it.
Because what you're left with is this thick soup of, like, super concentrated sewage.
How much do you smell? Do you smell it on... I have
it
on my tongue.
Oh, yeah, no, it smells. Yeah. No, no, it smells. Let's get out of here.
I smell it, yeah.
No.
And once you have that soup, you take that...
We put it through a centrifuge where we mechanically spin it.
Yes. Salad spinner?
Well, it's kind of like the spin cycle in your washing machine.
And it basically sweats out all the additional moisture.
And what I'm left with is real concentrated, like 30% solids, like moist soil.
A ton of it.
There's 125 million gallons of it.
And if you want to like try to picture that in your mind, I did, that much sludge, that's what this stuff is called, would fill the Rose Bowl. I'm not even a football fan, but just like picture a big college football stadium filled with this concentrated sewage sludge. And that's what Steve's left with at the end of every single day. Which leads to the obvious question.
What do I do with that stuff?
And this is where the story takes a really strange turn.
This is where things got a little, how would you put it?
A little emotional.
Emotional.
Mike, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, Pat.
Ended up tracking down this guy named Mike.
Mike Sharp.
Who was hired to answer this question. Like, what do we do with New York City's processed sewage sludge? He says for a while...
They hauled it 103 miles out in the ocean and dumped it.
Just like before. But
eventually what happened was
in 1988, the government
banned all ocean disposal of waste.
And because New York City had been dumping so much of this stuff in the ocean for so long, the EPA said not only do you have to stop dumping in the ocean, you have to find something good to do with some of it.
Beneficial reuse of biosolids.
This is our sewage guy, Steve, again. And he says you can use the sludge as
fertilizer. Can use as fertilizer.
Steve told us that lots of cities do this.
There's a product, you can go to Home Depot and buy a bag of Milorganite.
What's that?
Milorganite is biosolids for Milwaukee.
So when you buy a bag of Milorganite and spread it over your tomatoes, you're actually using treated poop from the people of Milwaukee.
They've marketed it for a retail sale.
And this is basically where Mike comes in. It was his job to sell our sludge.
So, you know, off I went.
Is this like a thing he does?
Yeah, he'd done it in other places for other towns, but this time,
start spreading the news.
It didn't go the way it usually does. He doesn't remember exactly who he approached first, but state
Alabama
after state
Ohio
after state
Indiana
said no.
I can remember one state, I won't even mention who, but you know, the comment was made, you're not going to get New York City here. Don't even think about it.
There were towns that would accept biosolids from every city in the planet except New York City.
Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Alabama.
We don't want New York City biosolids.
Oh, like ours is worse, huh?
We don't want city slicker biosolids.
The objections were all over the map. The sludge will have toxins in it or disease or like who knows. You know, it'll have the city in it. Even though technically when they tested it, it was no different than the sludge from anywhere else.
It's the same stuff.
But
Illinois,
over
Kansas,
and over again,
Kentucky, and
here's the same thing.
Don't think you're ever going to get New York City permitted here.
I feel a little, I haven't even lived here that long, and I feel insulted.
Yeah, no, so it's you're a resident of New York, it's us. Yeah. This is a collective effort here, you know, that's
there was a prejudice against New York City versus almost any other sludge in the country.
And I should mention that at a certain point, Mike started offering to give this stuff away for free. And still, nobody wants it. Until...
it was kind of just one of those flukes of life.
He got to Colorado.
I got lost coming out of the airport.
Huge thunderstorm.
Thought I was going north, ended up going south.
And all of a sudden, he's...
yeah, about 75 miles east of Denver.
You went pretty far south.
Like I said, I was lost in a big thunderstorm and went to the first town I found a hotel. So
anyway, next morning, he wanders down to the coffee shop, gets to talking with some guy and telling him, I've got all of the sludge in New York City and I just want to put it on a train and bring it out to the farms in Colorado.
His response is, you're going to do what?
Typical reaction.
You're going to put something from New York City on a rail car and haul it all the way here?
But then he paused and said, keep talking.
And we talked about the concept.
And before Mike knew it, he'd found a place that would accept New York City's unwanted sludge.
Fertilizer's fertilizer. That plant doesn't care what it comes from.
This is Wayne.
Wayne Schultz.
He ended up running the operation in Colorado.
Our track out there would hold 17 train cars.
And this is how the New York City poop train began. A couple days before Earth Day 1992, several thousand tons of New York City sludge left the Big Apple, headed for Lamar, Colorado, 1,600 miles away. But it wasn't exactly an immediate success.
Well, I think
the whole thing started out pretty small.
Initially, there was just three or four farms that were using it.
This guy's one of the first farmers to start using it.
Sure. My name's John Stulp.
And John says he remembers early on,
the public was invited to come out
and comment on what they thought about the biosolids.
And it conjured up some very strong emotions. One person said something that they were concerned if any of this got spilled out of the trucks transporting it onto the highway, that it would probably eat a hole in the asphalt and have to be treated like a nuclear disaster site.
And there were people who said their horse had died from biosolids.
I never heard the horse story, but I can tell you one about a cow.
You know, I think it's typical that people are always suspicious of something that's from far away.
But then the farmers who were using it started to notice that it was kind of awesome.
I remember going to a farmer's field.
Not long after he'd started using the biosolids.
The previous wheat crop was 40 bushel.
But after using the biosolids,
he cut 66 bushel wheat.
His crop increased by a third.
You never hear 66 bushel.
John says they started to notice other little things about it too.
We had a lot of trouble with an aphid called the Russian wheat aphid. But we saw an interesting thing with a couple neighbors east of me.
When they put the biosolids on their field, it kept the aphids away. And it wasn't just aphids.
We have a big prairie dog problem out here.
One farmer told Wayne when he put the biosolids on his field,
they packed up and moved across to the neighbor. And he thought it was a human scent.
And as word got out, Wayne started getting calls from all over the county.
Well, put me on the list. Put me on the list. I want some of that.
There was a waiting list.
Because as the New York City biosolids had gained acceptance in Colorado, other states had started picking them up too.
I had a list of 50 farmers wanting the product.
And after a few years, they were getting a trainload pretty much every week.
We covered maybe 10,000 acres a year, and we had enough demand to cover, farmer demand, that we could easily cover 50 to 75,000 acres a year.
And here is what I think is the most amazing part of this whole story. You take a farmer like John, who accounts for a big chunk of those acres. John's growing wheat.
Yes, the hard red winter wheat.
And the wheat?
Goes primarily into bread type of products.
A lot of bread type products.
With a pound of wheat, roughly just a rule of thumb is you get about a loaf of bread.
And if you do some quick math, he said you get about 2,000 pounds of wheat from each acre that you farm. And so that's 2,000 loaves of bread per acre times the 10,000 acres that the biosolids were on.
So just keep adding zeros. And so we're up into the around 20 million loaves of bread or something like that.
And that's each year. So we're talking hundreds of millions of loaves of bread, which means, John says,
you may well have eaten a slice of bread that had a grain or two of wheat that come from our farm.
And so, like, in some small but very real sense, that's a slice of bread that we helped make with the stuff that we, like, make.
Biosolids from New York come from the bread that they ate that went into their sewer system and end up in their wastewater treatment plant and ended up in Colorado. And then, the cycle begins again. It was ultimate in recycling.
This is a magical thing. That's Fred again, the writer from the beginning of the story.
It's really going from a straight line, make it go away and never return, to a circle.
The end is in the beginning.
I was standing by my
but
window.
It turns out that's not the end of the story.
Since I turned off utilities and locked the doors.
A couple weeks ago, we sent a reporter out to Colorado to hang out with Wayne.
All I'm seeing here is a bunch of empty buildings.
These are our buildings.
Empty, everything shut down.
Everything shut down.
And what she found is that the circle had become a straight line again.
At least I could have shown it when it was in operation.
Wayne told her that for a long time, things were great.
At one time, summer 07, I had 26 employees. Everybody hopping. And it was slowly, New York had come in and, well, you got to cheapen up your price. We've got somebody else will do this cheaper. And the economy, prices of diesel fuel, the railroad cost of transportation, just slowly it got down to four employees and myself. And all they have to do is send you a 30-day written notice and your contract's gone. That's what happened.
I remember the last day, our last load, which happened to be 20 years the day of our first load showing up. Our first load showed up on Earth Day 1992, and our last load showed up April 22nd, 2012. And we sat there and watched the last load be spread across the farm ground there.
Yeah. What New York does with it now, they go to landfills. They mix it with garbage and they bury it in landfills. Like I said, it's kind of sad to come in here and see it now, nothing.
Wait, hold on a second. I mean, I obviously feel for Wayne and all those people who lost their jobs, but it sounded to me a little nuts from the beginning that we would put our bio, whatever it's called, on a train and put it all the way to Colorado. That must cost a lot of money.
Yeah, it's kind of nuts. It's costing like millions of dollars. And we've always put some of it in a landfill. It's just that now we put about half of it into a landfill and half of it into like abandoned strip mines, and none of it goes to Colorado.
Well, how much are we saving by not putting it on trains and sending it across the country? Like, what's the...
Well, like, so according to Mike and Wayne, it's about half as expensive to put it in a landfill as it was to send it to Colorado, which mm-hmm. sounds like a lot. But if you add it up, if you add up the cost of sending all of this stuff that we were sending to Colorado, and you add up the cost of the landfill, and you do the subtraction, and you divide it across, like, let's just say, like, 8 million people, it would cost... you, Robert Krolwich, about 25 cents a month to send it back.
That's it.
For a quarter.
God, that's nothing. I would have expected the answer to be a lot more than that.
Me too.
Come on, New York, do the right thing.
Can we store our own...
Pride. Integrity, you know?
And integrity. In the fields of Colorado.
Yeah, we could close the circle again.
Close the circle.
We'll be right back.
Yes, sir.
Hey, Radiolab, this is Adam in Toronto. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org. That was my best impression of the effect.
Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Radiolab is supported by Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture. You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing. It's a lifestyle that may not be for you, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. How? Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends, all before you head out the door. Your money is a workaholic, but you don't have to be because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Hey, Lulu here. You asked and we listened. You wanted a Zuzve shirt and we made one. It is a gorgeous celebration of the liminal being that is Venus's moon / not moon. And you yourself can sport this homage to the unknowable multitudes of those all around you and within you by simply joining the lab. The Lab is our membership program that is the place where we fight the fight against the fickle whims of the economy to make our show protected from all that based on listener support. If you sign up, we thank you with the brand new Zuzve t-shirt and also ad-free episodes, bonus interviews, and other swaggy stuff like stickers and patches. You can go check out the perks and see if it's right for you by going to radiolab.org/join. And thank you, either way, for being here, for listening to our show. We make it for you, Zve. Anyway, radiolab.org/join. Check it out, and thanks.
Three, two, one. Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and for this next segment...
we have a puzzle. Yeah, it's a puzzle.
It's a puzzle. It is a puzzle, and it comes from NPR's East Africa correspondent, Gregory Warner.
I prepared for this story by taking a jog through Nairobi.
Well, all right, so where do we start with this, Greg?
I think we should start in 1968. Okay. So, 1968, Summer Olympics in Mexico City.
Mexico City, thankfully a city of peace on the Olympic opening day.
At 7,900 feet, one of the highest elevated Olympics. And that's difficult for runners because there's less oxygen. And one of the big races that everybody's looking forward to is the 1,500 meter between the 23-year-old American favorite, Jim Ryan.
Jim Ryan of America, number 300.
He's the world record holder. And this guy named Kipchoge Keino.
Kip Keino of Kenya, number 565.
Kip Keino, he's called.
Kip Keino.
They bill him as an untrained Nandi tribesman from Kenya. He's actually a policeman from a long line of cattle rustlers. 200 meters, Martin Woodruff was to win a silver. And here's what you need to know about Kip. He's running three different races at this Olympics.
The 1,500 meters.
Not only the 1,500, but also the 5,000 meter and the 10,000 meter. If you include the qualifying matches, he'll be running six Olympic events in 8 days.
Wow.
Six races in 8 days, which would never be done today, was hardly done then. So first up,
the 10,000 meter
race. He's in the lead, two laps away from finishing when he collapses. He falls off the track. He gets rushed to the Kenyan doctor, who's a German guy, who diagnoses him with a gallbladder infection, which turns out is incredibly painful. Actually hurts the most when you take deep breaths, like when you're running. And if you don't treat it, your gallbladder could burst. So basically the doctor sends Kip to bed, says there's no way you can run. But Kip, he runs the next race anyway, ends up getting silver.
Wow.
He's sent to bed by the German doctor again, who literally says, okay, this time you have to stay in bed. If you run any more races, you could die.
Back to the track for one of the most memorable events of the whole games, the 1500 meters.
3 days later, it's the big matchup against Jim Ryan. And Kip, apparently he just leapt out of bed an hour before the race, and he said something like, if I die, I'm going to die on the track. So Kip Kano starts off.
They're off and running. 3 3/4 laps of the stadium.
He starts out dead last.
Kano running last and then moving up to the middle of the pack now.
By the end of the first lap, he's in third.
Norpoth of Germany second and Kip Kano third.
In the third lap, he takes the lead.
And here comes Kip Kano coming up with his teammate.
He goes ahead, but that's okay for Jim Ryan. Jim Ryan's known to have the greatest kick in the sport.
Kick?
Kick. Right at the end of the race, every runner gives this extra boost. And Ryan's got the best kick in the business.
Jim Ryan is beginning to move.
So he's thinking,
the kick is beginning.
There's no way that Kip Kano, at altitude, suffering a gallbladder infection, can hold out against my kick.
He's closing very rapidly.
And in the final lap, it looks like he's right.
He can do it.
He starts shooting up the field, gaining on Kip Kano, who is clearly in pain. He's sort of grimacing, gritting his teeth.
300 yards left, the crowd going mad.
Lurching.
Kano, 200 meters left.
To the finish line. And even though he is in an ungodly amount of pain, even though pain is shooting through his entire body, amazingly,
and Kano will never be caught.
He does not slow down. Jim Ryan never catches him.
Kenyon beaten in the 5,000 meters for speed.
And he wins.
The world record hold on the way home. And Ryan completely misjudged it.
When he hung on around that last turn, it was, oh, I was hysterical.
This is John Manners.
I'm a semi-retired journalist who for many years had a specialty in covering the exploits of Kenyan runners, African runners in general.
He was watching that race in a
bar about 50 miles north of New York.
But as a kid, Manners actually lived in the part of Kenya that Kip Kano is from.
My people.
And so and when Kano won gold, it sparked a question for Manners that he would spend the next 40 years thinking about.
I wanted to find a reason why my people, as I chose to regard them, were great.
Because on that day in 1968, Kip Kano didn't just win a race. He ushered in an era of East African dominance in the sport.
It's Kenya 1, it's Kenya 2, it's Kenya 5.
That is almost hard to believe.
The Kenyans have done it again. 1, 2, and 3.
Yep, it was once again the Kenyans, the 8th successive gold medal in Olympic history.
It's a world record! A world record!
So 1968 was the beginning of the Kenyan dominance in running?
Yeah, but in the United States, we think of Kenyans as being good runners. But really, it's this one tiny, small geographic swath
within Kenya,
where all the runners come from.
That's David Epstein. He's a senior editor at Sports Illustrated. He wrote a book called The Sports Gene. And the geographic swath that he's talking about is in western Kenya. It's a mountainous region spread out about the size of Massachusetts. And the people who live there are a particular tribe of Kenyans called
the Kalenjin.
Pretty small group of people.
This tribe accounts for about 0.06%
of the world's population. But from this one tiny tribe has come
this unbelievable fount of talent that I think is unparalleled in any other sport ever.
There's all kinds of statistics.
It sort of becomes laughable. There have been 5 American high school runners who have broken 4 minutes in the mile.
The first was actually Jim Ryan.
But there's 1 high school in E10 in Kenya that had 4 sub-4 milers at the same time. There are 17 American men in history who have run under 2:10 in the marathon. That's about 4 minutes and 58 seconds per mile pace. 17 American men in history. There were 32 Kalenjin who did it in October of 2011. So you start to look at these statistics, and it appears to be the greatest concentration of elite athletic talent ever in any sport anywhere in the world.
And that's the question.
I mean, how does that happen?
That was John Manners' question 40 years ago.
Something has to account for this extraordinary set of numbers.
But what? Well, according to John Manners,
people talked a lot about altitude and the ability to process oxygen and what have you.
Other people have said it's because the Kalenjin have a high starchy diet. Or
because they run to school. This is a very prominent phenomenon. We know that the runners that come from the Kalenjin tribe that become great runners, they're much more likely to have run to and from school long distances, like 10K to and from school.
But
there are millions of kids in Kenya who run to and from school.
Or who live at altitude. The problem with all of these is that these are not specific to the Kalenjin.
Yeah.
So then you get the socioeconomic arguments. The salary of a runner is attractive. You know, $10,000 or $20,000 a year seems like a fortune worth striving for. But the country is not so poor that it can't send competitors to the athletic competitions.
This is Malcolm Gladwell's argument, actually.
Very close.
Yeah.
There's a social pressure to it. This is how you get out.
Yeah, and there's so many role models. I mean, every village has some kind of champion.
Yeah.
The problem with that argument, I mean, there's actually no problem with the argument. It makes sense, but it doesn't say how the Kalenjin got so good in the first place, that they created these role models.
I mean, where did the role models come from?
So the idea you're left with is maybe there's something genetically different about them that makes them better than us. This is obviously a dangerous idea. And in fact, when David Epstein was writing his book about sports and athletics,
I almost backed out of writing the book because I realized I was going to have to address ethnic differences and gender differences. There were scientists who confessed to me that they were withholding data.
That they had studies that showed a genetic advantage, but they wouldn't show him because they were afraid that they'd lose tenure. But he says you have to acknowledge the obvious.
One aspect of innate biology that clearly helps Kalenjin, that's been studied by scientists, is their body build. So the Kalenjin are what's called a Nilotic people. They have ancestry at very low latitude. I was crisscrossing the equator when I was visiting their training camps. And when you have your ancestry in a hot and dry climate, you evolve a certain body type for cooling. And we know this. We've known this for over a century. It's called Allen's Rule, that organisms, not just humans, all organisms that evolve in hot and dry climates have a certain body type.
Namely?
Very long and thin limbs, so that there's a lot of surface area through which heat can dissipate. Their limbs get thinner the farther away they get from their center of gravity. So they have extremely thin ankles and extremely thin calves, which is particularly important because your leg is like a pendulum. And the more weight you have farther away from your center of gravity, the more difficult it is to swing. This has been tested in the lab too, right? So you take a runner and put 8 pounds of weight around their waist. It increases the energy they have to use to run at a given pace. But if you take that same 8 pounds and put it in the form of 2 4-pound weights around their ankles, it's like over 25% the increase in energy they need to run at the same pace.
And so it gets you to this place where you think, well, I don't know, maybe Kalenjin from this area, maybe they have this built-in advantage.
Hmm.
It's physics.
I don't know. Somehow, like, to sort of just peg it all on physics smells like an argument that I really don't like.
No, nobody likes it.
I don't think it's a question of like or dislike. I think it's just not the reason I watch the Olympics. I mean, you know, going back to Kip Kano, who overcame a gallbladder infection to break the Olympic world record in 1968. He didn't win because he had thin ankles. He won because of something which is the reason we watch sports. You know, it's that essence, the willpower or
triumph over adversity.
Right.
The triumph of the human over everything.
Yes.
And this is where I ran across a completely new, fascinating, and somewhat terrifying way of explaining why the Kalenjin are so good. And it's an idea that eventually led me to go to Kalenjin country myself.
That's a perfect way of beginning, a little cow hoot.
So you get to Iten, which is in the mountains. The air is cool. There's a lot of cows, a lot of people. And at around 5:30, 6 a.m., all you hear is the pitter-patter of feet. Hmm. And then all these people just pass you all of a sudden. And then, you know, you wait for a few more seconds and then people pass you again because everybody's running. I even started morning jogging when I was there. I'm not really a morning jogger, but I just kind of got into the flow. Anyway, while I was there, I met this guy. His name's Brother Colm O'Connell.
Colm O'Connell. I'm Irish, of course. Came to Kenya in 1976.
Famous running coach who works with a lot of Kenyan runners. When I asked him this question, what is it that makes the Kalenjin so good? This is what he told me.
When you train an athlete to a high level, you need to remember that they live on the edge of injury. They live on the edge of overtraining. They live on the edge of pain.
Pain.
Pain tolerance, yes.
Now look, to some degree, Everybody who's a runner talks about this insidious, protean nature of pain, how it finds all the places. You become breathless and your lungs have needles. The best runners have to learn to mentally override these distress signals, to run despite the pain. He actually calls it expanding your pain barrier.
Yeah, so they are tough.
But Colm O'Connell says for the Kalenjin, pain is something else entirely.
You know, your ability to withstand pain, that in a sense in the Kalenjin tradition made you a man.
Quite literally.
The central event of their young lives will come up when they are going to be initiated into the tribe.
That's John Manners again. Remember, he spent part of his childhood in Kalenjin territory. And he says when he was a boy, say 12 years old, he would notice his friends had scars on their arms and legs.
Marks of having burned their arms and legs with hot coals.
He soon learned they were practicing for this initiation moment.
You know you're facing it for 10 years at least.
Because as a Kalenjin teenager, boy or girl, you have to go through an experience which is so painful, it's a kind of theatrical orgy of pain. And here's what happens. First, you have to crawl naked through stinging nettles, which is like formic acid, you know, and African stinging nettles are much, much stingier than the Western stinging nettle. But then your fingers are squeezed together. Then you get beaten on that bony part of your ankle where it really hurts. But all that's just warm up, because then one morning comes the circumcision. Now, we have some idea of how circumcision works. Maybe some of us are circumcised. So you perform it on a baby, and it's one kind of experience. I've gone through that myself. I've seen it done. I've had to hold the legs also of my nephew. It's hard. But the Kalenjin circumcise somewhere right after puberty, so around age 13 to 17. The foreskin is not only cut, but it's tied into a bow. More than the tied into the bow thing, I got to stop there. I kind of froze. I don't really know how to describe it past there.
I believe the either the top or the bottom of the foreskin is pierced, and then the head of the penis is pushed through the opening. And
the thing is, it's not just the cut, actually.
When he undergoes the operation, he is obliged to be absolutely stoical, still unflinching.
So in some versions of this ceremony, mud is caked on the face, and then the mud is allowed to dry. If a crack appears in the mud, your cheek may twitch, your forehead may crinkle, and if that happens, a little crack will appear in the mud, and all the people around will know to immediately start beating you with large sticks. The worst part, though, is not just the beating. It's that after that moment, if you don't make it through this ceremony, you get labeled a kebitet, a coward. You're a pariah in society. You're not part of society. In the olden days, you didn't have access to the economic opportunities to afford what's called the bride price, which is what you need to get a wife. However, if you show yourself to be a true warrior, if you make it through this experience, then hey, you get the rights of reproduction. You may even have two or three wives. So Manners wondered, and he's just speculating here, but maybe if you have 2,000 years of this sexual selection, of ensuring that the stoical, tough guy types get to have babies, the sensitive types don't. Maybe it's not just that the Kalenjin are built for speed. It's not just that they have the body type. Maybe they have some sort of innate ability mentally to persevere through pain.
Huh. And is that a cultural ability, or would he say that all that selection has filtered into their DNA in some way?
Well, so Manners says he isn't sure. And there's certainly no gene for stoicism that's been discovered. And any athletic success has to be ascribed to a host of factors. All right, so I was in E10. I was thinking about that question. And I met this kid named Eli Kipkoge. He's 19 years old. He's a self-described bookworm.
From the very beginning, I never wanted to go through the traditional form of circumcision because I knew the ordeal, as in it was so bad.
And actually what he said was, please circumcise me in the hospital. I want to do the cowardly way. But his relatives said, no, you'd shame the entire family. And if you don't do it...
You're not a full man. That's how they put it.
So he felt like he had to just do it.
It was so hard. There's beatings. You're supposed to stay for 9 hours inside the cold water. Then early in the morning, around 7 in the morning, circumcision. They use a sharp stick. I hope you understand that, a sharp stick. So it's just bad.
He said the whole initiation ritual actually went on for a couple of weeks. It was more than just the cut. And during the whole time, he was kept in a hut on the outskirts of the village. His face was powdered white like a ghost. And he was told, whenever you leave this hut...
You are not allowed to walk.
You're not allowed to walk.
So you're supposed to run. Very fast. So you're running very swift. Having the pain, so...
And before the circumcision, Ellie was never a runner. Afterwards, when he was done with initiation and he was back in high school,
I said, oh, let me give it a try. So I could run and I feel pain, I'm feeling pain, and I wanted to stop. Then I realized, no, let me try to persevere. Let me try one more time. And 2 minutes later, I'm at school.
Ellie joined his track team, started running to school and during his lunch times.
And after training for 2 weeks and 3 weeks there, I became an expert and I was known as the school athlete.
After how long?
After 2 weeks alone. 2 weeks alone.
2 weeks?
That's how it began.
That's a crazy story. Is that really true?
Yeah, it is true. So probably my ability of running was a bit higher than the rest.
Turns out Ellie's mom was an accomplished athlete.
Okay, so you're saying you had some physical ability to run, but you just didn't really do it before.
I never realized that I could run.
So we didn't talk at all about women, but Kalenjin girls also go through an initiation rite of their own, female genital mutilation.
Same type of ritual?
Not the same ceremony, but a similar type of stoical testing ceremony.
And to me, this made no sense.
This is John Manners again.
Obviously, the women are not the warriors. They don't need to be brave. Why is it important for them to show courage during this operation? And when I asked this question of my Kalenjin friends many years ago, they were kind of astonished at the question, as though the answer should have been self-evident. And the answer they gave me was, a woman who shows cowardice during this operation might bear cowardly sons.
So some Kalenjin might say that Ellie actually got two things from his mom. One was his physical prowess, his speed on the track. The other was a mental ability to persevere through pain.
Yeah, people usually say it's called a blessing. In Kalenjin, you call it beruta. Blessing is what you get from probably your forefather, probably your grandmother. So he or she blesses you with that activity. That's what they used to say, the blessing.
Well, that's pretty interesting.
That's interesting.
That although we're using inheriting words or blessing words, what we're really talking about is the pressure of a culture that is simply choosing to deeply psychically reward certain behaviors and create expectations for those behaviors and create success around those behaviors. Those are all cultural, not biological things, but they are the equivalent.
I think it's both. And I don't know what proportion each contributes to the ultimate result. I have no way of judging.
But whatever the mechanism, and whatever it is, it'll probably stay a mystery. Of all the explanations out there for why this one group of people is so good at running, this is the first one that's made me want to run. Once I met Ellie and talked to these runners in Kenya, you know, this is an embarrassing story because I don't run very fast, but I got to the gym and I was on the treadmill and I was like, I'm taking it up to 7, you know? 7 miles an hour, like 7.1 actually I went. And, you know, that's not like very fast, but that would usually be my end run. Like at the last 5 minutes, I might do a 7.1, but I did the whole 25 minutes at 7.1. And I thought, why did I ever think that this was undoable before? Why was I staying at like 6.8? If we're trying to figure out what makes these runners so great, and our first answer is a totally scientifically, factually true, but somehow demoralizing absolute that puts one set of people over there and the rest of us over here. We all have our body type that we're born with. But then if the second explanation of this Kalenjin advantage may be just as inaccessible to the rest of us, but still it feels like a more egalitarian version of advantage, even if we're talking about a very specific culture.
Yeah, I think if you run with this extreme pain for a month after having been circumcised, and somehow that gave you a certain culturally troubling but also real relationship to pain, well, that feels like a fair advantage to me. Not that I would wish it on anyone.
Actually, even Ellie does not wish it on his kids. when he has kids.
The system is changing from the traditional format to the new format right now.
I mean, he's part of a new generation of Kalenjin. He says for his contemporaries, the pain-free hospital circumcision is becoming slowly less of a stigma.
And I can't imagine my son going through the same procedure as their father. So my son or my sons won't go through the same procedure as I did.
But don't you want your son to have the benefits of what you...
The benefit's only about the perseverance part of it. And I believe perseverance can get through many ways.
He tells himself he's going to be able to pass on those Kalenjin values without resorting to the ancient rituals.
I will teach him how to persevere.
And he thinks his kids will still be able to be champion runners, if that's what they want to be.
Thanks to Gregory Werner, NPR's East Africa correspondent.
Also, we should say thanks to Fia Benin for production help on this piece. Thank you, Fia. And thank you guys for listening. I'm Jad.
I'm Robert.
And we'll be right back.
This is AJ Squillante calling from Chicago, Illinois. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Radiolab is supported by Babbel. Sometimes self-improvement can feel like a pretty overwhelming journey. So what if this year you just got a tiny bit better every day? When you're learning a new language with Babbel, that's exactly what you're doing. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app with quick 10-minute lessons that have been handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. You can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations, café s'il vous plaît, from vocabulary words to culture and more. And if Babbel can help you start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, imagine what you could do in a few months or a full year. Here is a special limited-time deal for Radiolab listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/radiolab. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/radiolab, spelled BABBEL.com/radiolab. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Should we say our names?
Yes, let's at least do that.
All right. Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and we are back for this next story.
I think Soren's going to be doing the next story, isn't he?
Yeah. Do you want to carry it, Soren?
Sure.
Do it.
So today we have a story of an obsession that swallowed reporter Dan Engber pretty much whole.
Yeah.
Of all the things to catch your attention, how did this happen to pop into your head?
It happened to pop into my head because I was talking to a friend of mine who's an elementary school teacher, and we were discussing quicksand, as one does.
Oh, of course.
This elementary school teacher and I. And she just said, you know, the kids in my class just don't even, they've never heard of quicksand.
Like second graders, third grade, like what?
Nine-year-olds.
Nine-year-olds. Well, that's
graders?
Like fourth graders.
That's prime time for quicksand.
Right. But so I went to her, I visited her class, and I discovered that she was wrong. Almost all of them had heard of quicksand, but she was right insofar as quicksand was not important to them. In fact, they thought it wasn't scary at all. And I was like, well, what are you afraid of? And they said, you know,
zombies, the alien in Pacific Rim,
ghosts.
When I was actually lost in writing,
being attacked by a dinosaur,
that would be totally more scary.
So we actually went and talked to some third graders, and while some of them said,
well, I guess it's sort of scary, but
most of them weren't scared of it at all.
I don't think so.
I usually don't think about it.
They thought it was something that maybe their parents had been afraid of.
My dad told me that when he was little, his friends always said, like, look out, that could be quicksand.
Did friends ever say that to you?
No.
They would say people used to be scared of that, but it's not scary anymore. So that got me to thinking, what happened? Why is quicksand not scary the way it used to be?
And with that simple question, Dan got sucked into a world he never even knew existed.
So the next step was going to the internet, and within a minute, I discovered the quicksand fetish community.
The quicksand fetish.
Yeah.
Like fetish? Like sex fetish?
Yes.
Oh.
So among the quicksand fetishists, there are so-called sinkers. These are people who seek out quicksand in nature and want to jump in.
With another person and kiss, or by themselves with no clothes on, or where's the sex part?
Some of them by themselves with no clothes on. Some smaller group with another person. That's if they can convince their partner to come with them. But
they always have a rope with them, I hope.
Oh, yeah. Oh, if you go on to the sinkers message boards, there's a Google map which has sinking spots all over the world, and each one is rated for, you know, thickness, depth, privacy, available parking nearby. I mean, it's like a very thought through and wonderfully collaborative community.
Oh, wow.
So there's sinkers on one hand, and then there are the watchers. They just want to see people or animals sinking into quicksand. So they'll watch movies and just find the quicksand sequence in the movie.
And here's where Dan sunk even deeper. Because he discovered that one of these watchers,
this guy Crypto,
had, in the course of his fetishistic quicksand watching,
collated this, you know, this list of well over 1,000 quicksand scenes.
It's quicksand!
In film and television.
Quicksand.
Quicksand. This part of the country?
No way.
That's
nice. There were scenes going all the way back to the birth of filmmaking.
I mean, this is the greatest impetus for scientific research.
I ought to take off your shoe and paddle you.
If you have like a fetishistic interest in the data.
And Dan thought, maybe this data can give us a clue about how the way we think about quicksand has changed.
So I went through and I pulled out every feature film from the list. And then with information from the MPAA, I figured out how many movies were being released every decade. And then I sort of computed what percent of movies had quicksand in every decade. Going back to the first quicksand movie they have is from 1909. It's a silent film where a woman gets rescued from quicksand by some hooded monks. I'm unable to find this movie, but I'd love to see it. I don't know what it's about. But anyways, I started looking at the number of movies by decade, and the beginning of the century, it's like 1 in 1,000 movies. By the 30s, it's up to 1 in 500. And then in the 40s, 1 in 200. And then in the 1960s, all of a sudden, it just shoots up. Like 1 in 35, like almost 3% of Hollywood movies have quicksand. The 1960s are just clearly a moment for quicksand.
And Dan says, it wasn't just the number of films. The quicksand scenes that showed up in the 60s were serious, dramatic scenes. For example,
Lawrence of Arabia, where Peter O'Toole is, you know, pushing through the dust storm to try to save his companion who's being sucked under. That movie won 7 Oscars. And then Woman in the Dunes came out. This, like, artsy Japanese existentialist meditation.
And for about the next 10 years, Dan says, you had all these serious films that featured quicksand.
And then
it fell off dramatically.
In the 1970s, it's already fallen to something like 1 out of 75. And then by the 1980s, it's like 1 out of 130. And then in the 90s, quicksand is mostly gone.
Huh.
And I think also in the 80s, it had migrated into
Belty, help.
Television.
I'm stuck in quicksand.
Boy, are you having one bad day.
Larry and Belky and Perfect Strangers are falling into quicksand. There's quicksand in My Little Pony. There's quicksand in Rainbow Pride. I mean, it's zany quicksand.
Basically, Dan says, quicksand had become a joke.
And so, and that's the end, I think, when quicksand's in, you know, Saturday cartoons.
I do think that adventure gags probably have a lifespan. And
so just for a gut check, Dan and I decided maybe we should run this past somebody who knows the business.
I'm Carlton Cuse, and I'm a television writer and producer.
And Carlton was actually the showrunner for the TV show Lost.
And that's a show that by rights should have tons of quicksand. I mean,
absolutely, they
should be in quicksand all the time. They're stranded on a tropical island. It's an adventure show.
But according to Carlton, whenever one of the writers would say, you know,
okay, so Kate goes running down a path and then all of a sudden she falls into a pit of quicksand,
the rest of them would be like,
I don't know if we can really pull that off. So
what is that bag? Like, what is it that would make that not, I don't know.
You know, I just think a lot of people would sort of be rolling their eyes and not buying it. I know it sounds kind of crazy because, you know, here you are making sort of a crazy show with smoke monsters and polar bears and time travel. And for someone to say, no, but we don't believe quicksand. I know it's, but ultimately, you just sort of trust your gut, and just right now, where quicksand is just not sort of, I think, the right metaphor for how we're all feeling.
But in the 60s, it was.
Has someone speculated as to the reason why the 60s?
Oh, I've speculated at great length. I mean, it's a fascinating moment because it's not just in movies.
I believe that this nation should commit itself.
So, we're planning the moon mission in the early 60s.
Landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
And this Cornell astronomer named Thomas Gold says, what if when the Apollo lander descends to the surface of the moon, it just sinks into a lunar quicksand?
I remember this. I remember Tom Gold saying that, too.
Yeah, so right at this golden moment of quicksand, people are discussing real-life quicksand on the frontier of that era.
Now is the time.
And then 1963, Martin Luther King...
Now is the time.
...makes his I Have a Dream speech.
To lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice...
And he says, now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice.
This evening...
And then...
I came here to speak to you about Vietnam.
There was Vietnam.
I do not have to tell you that our people are profoundly concerned about that struggle.
You know, we now think of Vietnam as having been a quagmire. That's the rhetoric that's used now. But the debate in the 60s between Daniel Ellsberg and Arthur Schlesinger, they use quicksand and quagmire interchangeably. Ellsberg will switch off in one essay. He'll call it a quicksand and then a quagmire. But the first use of that idea was to describe it as a quicksand, and then it kind of migrates from being a quicksand to a quagmire over the course of the late 60s and early 70s. And now, I mean, more evidence. Now we call it a quagmire. We forgot that Vietnam was a quicksand before it was a quagmire. So on all of these levels, quicksand is just, you know, is part of these key moments of this 1960s.
Wow.
So the question that, you know, that was just, I was obsessed with for a long time was, why did America fall into quicksand in the 1960s? My sense is that it's had to do with just sort of a generalized anxiety about going someplace radically new. Anxiety about, you know, the hubris of traveling to the moon. Anxiety about social upheaval, anxiety about the foreign entanglement of Vietnam and the state of geopolitics.
But why would those anxieties manifest themselves in terms of like quicksand?
I think it's this idea that you're gonna get sucked in, you're gonna go too far, you're gonna get stuck in whatever new world you've ventured into. And right now, there isn't that anxiety of exploration anymore. I mean, quicksand in Shakespeare's time was always off the coasts of new continents. It had to do with the age of exploration. And then it became, you know, desert quicksand and jungle quicksand during colonial era. And I just think the world is...
And then it became the moon.
Yeah, and then it became the moon. And
well, look at all the real estate that's beyond the moon. Come on. I mean, you got like our solar system. You could have the quicksand of Jupiter?
Yes, absolutely. I think if we're going to land humans on some
or black holes, aren't black holes a kind of quicksand?
Yeah, this is my guarantee. If we're about to land humans on some planet, you know, beyond the moon, these thoughts of quicksand would reemerge.
Oh yeah.
This is Carlton Cuse again.
And now we're going to see this whole new chapter of Star Wars, and clearly...
It just so happens that the director, J.J. Abrams, is working on a whole new Star Wars movie.
Yes. And I think in the context of some strange new world, I think the audience would totally buy quicksand there.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping for.
Yeah.
I have another leading indicator of quicksand interest for you.
I have no idea what you're about to say. None.
So, when I was a kid, I played quicksand in the sandbox, but sandboxes disappeared in the 1990s, in New York City at least. I don't know what the story was in the rest of the country, but this paper came out in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it warned that there might be some asbestos derivative in sandbox sand. And the number of sandboxes in New York City went from something like 900 to 30 or 40 by the mid-90s.
And those kids that you talked to in that class, they had not likely mm-hmm. sat in a sandbox pouring water in the right. corner and worrying about
it. But sandboxes are back. The new imaginative play movement and playground redesign. So it's just we're going to have lots of sand and lots of water, and we want the kids mixing the water in the sand. So who knows? Maybe this is the front edge of quicksand coming back because kids are playing with water and sand in sandboxes in New York City.
Thank you, Saren.
Thanks, Saren, yeah. No problem. And I should say thanks to Dan Mengber. He's a writer and a columnist at Slate Magazine, where you can find his article about quicksand.
Yes, and if you're looking to find out anything else about the stories you heard today, check out our website, radiolab.org.
And thanks.
Yeah.